It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, we'll hear about astronaut Scott Kelly's return from a record-setting space mission and what it could mean for the future of space exploration.
Now, a new bill gets at a question we get asked a lot at the grocery store: paper or plastic? It's a question people have heard for decades after plastic bags made their debut in the 1970s. But some communities, from Wisconsin to Texas, have banned or tried to restrict the use of plastic bags on the local level, citing environmental damage.
A bill, backed by the Wisconsin Grocers Association and the Alliance of Wisconsin Retailers, passed the state assembly last month. It was approved by a Senate committee yesterday. It aims to prohibit these local-level bans because they say they can harm businesses and Wisconsin's overall economy.
Joining us now is Representative Mike Rohrkast, a Republican from Neenah, who represents the 55th District of Wisconsin and was the assembly sponsor for the bill. Representative Rohrkast, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you, Veronica and Rob. Thanks for having me on.
So why do you think that Wisconsin needs a bill to block any possible bans on plastic bags?
Well, really what this does is it provides uniformity throughout the state. And it not only helps businesses, but it also really helps consumers in the long run, because if each individual city or town would develop either restrictions or fees on certain types of containers or some of these bags, so to speak, it would increase cost to the manufacturer. Then the manufacturer probably is going to pass that cost back on to the consumer. The other thing I would add is the bill doesn't restrict in any way a recycling program. So if plastic bags are still used, or paper bags, cans, bottles, they can still be recycled according to local recycling programs. Matter of fact, I mean, that's something that I encourage, and I think many legislators do on both sides of the aisle.
Now, you say that this could end up being more expensive for business owners and that they would transfer that cost over to the consumer. I know that you have experience in the packaging industry. How do you see that playing out? Why would that cost more?
Well, okay, let's say, okay, I worked at Menasha Corporation, which we provided corrugated packaging. At the time, I don't know if they still supply it to Kimberly-Clark, but they used to supply various packaging to Kimberly-Clark. If, let's say that certain cities would put a restriction on maybe either the type of corrugated box or packaging that was used, either in terms of size or density or anything like that, then that would require Kimberly-Clark to order different orders or levels of packaging just to meet a particular market, like a city versus an entire state or in the country. That would then increase cost. Anytime you have smaller runs, or you have to change what you're doing, either in the design or in the even in the printing, can cause increased cost and handling. And then again, Kimberly-Clark would probably turn around and pass that on to consumers. Now, that's just a hypothetical example.
Do paper bags, or if they're made of cardboard, very thin cardboard, do they cost more than plastic bags?
That I couldn't actually tell you. I don't know that they actually cost more, or I'm not positive on that. Both can be recycled.
I want to look at the example of Stevens Point. Now, this is a city that has a recycling program that is in the red right now. It is costing the city money instead of giving the city money back.
Sure.
And so Stevens Point wants to ban plastic bags for the month of March. Should they be able to do that?
Well, again, I mean, I guess, there's got to be a balance between sometimes, I think, state and local regulations. If Stevens Point decides to ban plastic bags for one particular month, then that's going to require every store in that area to completely rethink and redo for that particular month what they're going to do for their customers, whether it's paper or some other form of a bag to use for their customers. Anytime you add that kind of disruption, you add cost into a system. I do understand that, the plastics, the pricing isn't the best right now, but that affects many industries in many different ways. So the price for recycled materials, whether it's plastic, paper, containers, glass. I mean, it goes up and down.
So to be clear, Stephen's point wants to encourage people not to use any plastic bags. They're not actually doing a ban, a proper ban by law. But do you think that if a city wants to do that for a month without it being a ban by law, would you support that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if they want to encourage the use of plastic bags or the use of, I try to either use paper myself or reusable bags. If I'm only buying one or two items, I tell them don't even give me a bag anymore. So, no, I think that there's lots of ways that communities can encourage people to be better consumers of packaging and to be more responsible. I would encourage that throughout the state.
We're talking right now with Republican Assembly Representative Mike Rohrkast from NENA. He was the assembly sponsor for a bill that would prohibit local bans on plastic bags, and that bill got approval from a Senate committee yesterday. Now, these bans are in place in cities across the country. Austin, Texas has one. Berkeley, California has one. And some science says that these bags don't biodegrade easily. They're toxic to ecosystems. Is it out of step environmentally to prohibit a ban on plastic bags?
You mean on a state level?
At the state level here in Wisconsin.
I guess I'd have to research. I have to take a look at that. I mean, I understand that point. The purpose of this bill isn't to regulate an item for the state. It's to prohibit very random restrictions on businesses and consumers being able to use the type of packaging that they would most want to use. So if there was something to look at a state level from that, I mean, that's something that, probably could take a look at.
Do you think that small businesses could be helped by a ban on plastic bags? Maybe if they went bag free, like you said, you sometimes don't even use a bag, would their costs be brought down ultimately?
Well, their costs could be, but they could do that on their own right now. And I mean, I think many of them are doing that on their own. I mean, a lot of them are encouraging people to bring their bags in from Festival Foods in the state to COPS, which was recently bought by Kroger. I mean, they do a lot to encourage. Actually, for every bag you bring in by yourself, you get a nickel credited to your bill at the COPS chain for groceries. So businesses are doing that on their own. Again, I think that the point is to allow people. This does not stop recycling programs. It does not hinder the encouragement. And matter of fact, I think, personally, I want to see more reuse of materials. When I worked at Oshkosh Corporation as well, and we made heavy trucks, and we would rebuild many of our vehicles for our customers over time. They would send them back to us, and we would rebuild them. So the whole idea of sustainable products, whether that's the actual product that's being sold or the packaging that it's involved, is something that businesses, government, and communities should really work positively on. I think what we want to prevent, though, is a patchwork system that creates really logistical nightmares for either a consumer company or a packaging company to deal with different regulations based on 30 different cities in the state of Wisconsin.
Are there specific Wisconsin cities that are wanting to look into banning plastic bags right now?
Well, I've heard that there's a few. I've heard maybe Milwaukee, Madison has looked at. I don't know if they were particularly on bags, but they were looking on certain restrictions in this area or adding certain fees onto these.
And have you heard from businesses that are concerned about the possibility?
Absolutely. I mean, I've heard from Georgia Pacific, a large employer here in the state, on many of the business organizations, that the Restaurant Association, the Grocers Association, they all support this. The packaging companies are very supportive. This Quick Trip is very supportive of this legislation.
Representative Rohrkast, thanks a lot for joining us.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Have a good day.
You too. That was Republican Assembly Representative Mike Rohrkast from NENA. He was the assembly sponsor for a bill that would prohibit local bans on plastic bags. The bill got approval from a Senate committee yesterday and will go on to the full Senate on March 15th. After nearly 1 year in space, NASA astronaut Scott Kelly has returned to Earth along with his Russian counterpart. Kelly safely landed in Kazakhstan earlier today and is now on his way back to the United States. Here's Kelly talking about his time in space during one of his first Back on Earth interviews.
Normal increment is about 6 months, and that's a long time, so a year is really, really long. But I'm definitely encouraged on our ability to go even longer. I mean, I kind of, you know, even though I look forward to coming home and there's things that I miss, I felt like if it was for the right reason, I clearly could have stayed, you know, however long it took.
Well, what he did stay was the longest amount of time an American astronaut has ever spent in space in one stretch. And NASA says the mission will provide beneficial knowledge on the medical, psychological, and biomedical challenges faced by astronauts during long-duration spaceflight. They hope that's going to pave the way for a manned mission to Mars in the next 20 years.
And here with us now to talk more about that mission and what happens now is, now that Kelly's back on Earth, is space journalist Elizabeth Howell. Elizabeth, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, and I like the distinction back on Earth.
Right, it's a different place to be right now. So this was a
pretty
amazing mission. Kelly spent a year in space. Seems like he could have just kept on going, and he's become sort of a celebrity in the process. He tweeted a lot. He tweeted with President Obama. He was on TV. He talked with Stephen Colbert. How significant an achievement, though, was this mission for NASA?
Oh, this mission was just an incredible journey to watch, and also for him, obviously, as a participant, because there was a lot of drama. You know, you could make a movie about all the stuff that happened to him while he was up there. They had two cargo spacecraft blow up, or one blew up and the other one was unable to reach them. And that caused sort of a shortage, almost a shortage of food on the International Space Station right off the bat. And then there was a mold problem around Christmas time with some of the plants that they were growing on the station. And Kelly actually stepped in and rescued them. He did three spacewalks. He did a whole bunch of really cool experiments, including some that involve his twin brother, Mark, who, yes, was also an astronaut as well. So there's just a lot of really neat things about this mission, and I really look forward to hearing about the science that comes out now that it's finished.
His timing is sort of fun, too. It coincides with the release of The Martian, where a lot of the similar stuff happened. Stuff blew up, there were spacewalks, there were plants grown. Do you think that was sort of part of the crossover appeal, real-life science crossing over with fiction?
I think that definitely was a help, because last night, for example, some people were tweeting, "Bring Scott home," which is a meme that reflects that famous poster that you saw of Matt Damon, where it said, "Bring him home," you know, "Bring Mark home." So people were definitely making a lot of connections to The Martian because of the length of time in space, the isolation, some of the drama. And, you know, they were growing plants up there. They weren't potatoes, but they were growing plants up there.
So he was...
And NASA also was positioning it, obviously, as a stepping stone to get to Mars. And so in that sense as well, it was a little bit like The Martian.
What do you think will be some of the most interesting science to come out of this mission?
I think that the twin study is going to be such a unique opportunity for NASA because they don't have any other twin astronauts at this time. So Mark Kelly did a few shuttle missions, and Scott Kelly has now been on the International Space Station twice, essentially for almost a year and a half. So what they're going to be doing is seeing how that long exposure in space could have changed Scott's genes over the years, because it's possible that the radiation or the exposure to weightlessness or some other factor may have some slight changes. Now, this will take some time to come back, obviously, because, you know, he just arrived. He's coming back to Houston tonight. So we're not going to see those results tomorrow. But if you just keep studying the news in the 6 months, a year, maybe even a couple of years, as they begin to see how he readjusts to Earth and how his genes might have altered, that might be really interesting.
I read that one of the things that happens in space with weightlessness is that the fluid leaves the lower part of the body and goes to the upper part. That's an interesting factor. Do we know how that could affect things?
Yes. One of the things that they're actually trying to figure out right now is if that fluid shift that makes the fluid migrate to the top of your body, essentially, if it's related to some of the vision problems that astronauts have experienced when they come back. There's a significant percentage, not everybody, but quite a few astronauts come back and they see that their eyesight has changed. Maybe they needed glasses now and they didn't used to before they went into orbit. And so what they're taking a look at right now is just basically a research project looking at that very question. And they're trying to figure out whether this is the case, They're trying to use also devices to draw the fluids back into the legs to kind of reduce that pressure, maybe stop the problem before it happens. So this will definitely be something they need to figure out before sending somebody out to Mars for a couple of years.
So as you say, a lot of fascinating science to come over the years as the science gets figured out, looking at Scott Kelly and his brother, not Mark Watney from The Martian. But what do you think about Scott Kelly just as an ambassador for outer space and the pictures he took and the way he seemed to get people drawn into that, to space exploration again?
The great thing about Kelly was he was such an ambassador for the experience of really being out there. And there have been a few astronauts that have been so gifted over the years, such as the Canadian Chris Hadfield back in 2012, 2013. And he would tweet Scott Kelly these amazing pictures down below, Art on Earth, and just show what was happening in Saudi Arabia that day, maybe. Or maybe he saw some sort of nice water swirling in the Bahamas. And so he would do that. He also wasn't afraid to crack a joke or two. He managed to smuggle a gorilla suit on board the International Space Station, for example. And he did a humorous video where he was kind of flying by wearing the suit with not much explanation as to what was going on. So he really had a way of making it fun, you know, in addition to sort of focusing, obviously, on the science and the maintenance and all the serious astronaut tasks. He definitely took his moments to appreciate the view, appreciate his experience up there. And, yeah, the more that we can do that, the more that we can bring people in, I think the more that we're going to be getting engaged in space exploration.
And, Elizabeth, just briefly before we let you go, as you said, NASA's goal is to send a manned mission to Mars by the year 2035. And this was about a year in space. What other big questions, though, does NASA still have to answer between now and then?
There are so many questions. We don't even know what kind of a habitat they would live in over there. There's a lot of studies going on, but they still have to figure that one out. They have to figure out how to get all the supplies over, and I'm talking food, oxygen. Think of all the things that you use every day, the equipment that you would need. And how to keep the people happy and productive is another big question, because a manned Mars mission would be, let's say, 2 years or maybe 3 years. And so they have a journey over, a journey back, where there's not much to look at the window, a lot of radiation exposure and risk, and, of course, something could happen, something could go wrong. And then when they get to the surface, they have to readapt themselves all of a sudden to being productive. They have to do a lot of tests very quickly.
And we leave it there. Elizabeth, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. Take care.
Now, space journalist Elizabeth Howell, she writes for space.com and other publications. She joined us to talk about astronaut Scott Kelly's return from a year-long mission in space. There are a lot of arguments over the best political response to mass shootings and other gun violence, but beyond the debate over gun control, there is often one thing people agree on across partisan boundaries, and that's the idea that mental health is a key part of the problem. President Obama's executive action on gun control last month included funding for mental health care and efforts to improve mental illness reporting for background checks.
And Republicans have agreed on that issue. Here's House Speaker Paul Ryan of Wisconsin in the immediate aftermath of the San Bernardino shootings in December, before it was clear what motivated those shootings.
This particular shooting in San Bernardino, there's just too much unknowns before we speculate about the origin of this one. But what we have seen in a common theme among many of these mass shootings is a theme of mental illness. And we need to fix our mental illness laws, our policies. They're outdated.
And here's GOP presidential candidate and Ohio Governor John Kasich responding to last week's shooting in Kalamazoo, Michigan.
Yeah, it's another issue of mental illness. And, you know, frankly, I'm doing everything I can in my state to make sure that we can take relief to those who live on the edge like that. But I want to be clear, just because somebody has mental illness has nothing to do with whether you're going to go do something to harm somebody else.
One problem with the bipartisan consensus, according to our next guest, mental illness is not a main factor generally in gun violence. Jeffrey Swanson joins us now. He's professor and associate director of the Division of Social and Community Psychiatry in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the Duke University School of Medicine. Jeffrey, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Well, there's a widespread belief, it seems, this comes up a lot, that mental illness is a primary driver of gun violence, of high-profile gun violence. To what extent is there really a connection?
Well, you know, we tend to focus on gun violence when there is a horrifying mass shooting by a very disturbed young man. But, you know, I'd like to help people remember that on any day when there is a mass shooting, 90 other people in the United States die as a result of a gunshot. and 90 the day before and the 90 day after that. So it's a big problem, and the mass casualty shooter is really atypical of that problem. The vast majority of people with serious mental illnesses are not violent, and the vast majority of the perpetrators of everyday gun violence do not have serious mental illnesses. So we do have a problem with mental health care in the United States, and there are good reasons to try to think about reforming that system. But if we did that, it's not necessarily going to address the problem of firearms injury and mortality in the United States as a public health problem.
Well, this brings up a number of angles. One, if we're overestimating a connection between mental health problems and gun violence, what harm does that do to people suffering from mental illness?
Well, you know, people act on the basis of what they believe to be true. And we have good public opinion poll data that dates back decades and that shows us that the large majority of adults in this country believe that there's a strong connection between mental illness and violence. So if you believe that people with mental illness are violent, you're going to act accordingly. I mean, imagine if you learned everything you knew about schizophrenia by watching television in this country. You'd think that every single person with serious mental illness was a homicidal monster, and that's not true. So what people do is, you know, if you're afraid of people with mental illness, then you're going to treat them with the scorn. You might want social distance from them. You might support public policies to restrict their liberties unnecessarily. You might discriminate against them in the distribution of benefits and rights in our society. And so, you know, I think it's the stigma, the social rejection that people with mental illnesses face is really exacerbated by this view that they are violent.
I've seen a lot of people make the case that one place where there is a connection that gets overlooked is not between mental illness and homicide, but mental illness and suicide. Here's President Obama in January announcing his gun control executive action.
High-profile mass shootings tend to shine a light on those few mentally unstable people who inflict harm on others, but the truth is that nearly 2 in 3 gun deaths are from suicides.
And does that need to be a bigger focus, a bigger priority, do you think, Jeffrey?
Absolutely. I mean, if you think about gun violence, again, from a population health perspective, what the president said is correct. I mean, 60-some percent of all gun fatalities are suicides. And there we have a different relationship with mental illness, because if we think about gun violence primarily in terms of homicide, interpersonal violence, serious mental illness is kind of a red herring. But if we think about it in terms of suicide, mental illness, serious mental illness, is a strong causal vector in suicide, accounting for probably 50 to 75% of the variability in suicide rates. So it's a little bit of a mixed message there for policy, because access to firearms is very important in both of those contexts. And, you know, as one of my friends in emergency medicine says, the brain doesn't care who fired the bullet. If a person fires it, him or herself, it's going to do just as much damage as somebody else.
Talking to Jeffrey Swanson about mental health and gun violence, he says the connection not always there, not in the way that people think it is. It's not solving mental illness will not solve gun violence in this country. And I want to get, we were just talking about suicide, Jeffrey, getting back to the problem with gun homicide now. Are you worried that overselling this link is kind of a red herring that's steering us away from more fruitful lines of thinking when it comes to causes of gun homicide? If we're paying too much attention to mental illness on this issue, what are we missing?
Well, violent behavior, whether we're talking about minor violent acts or serious violence with a gun that can kill people, is a complicated human behavior. It's caused by many factors that interact with each other in complicated ways. It's tempting to just try to find one master explanation and say that's the reason for it. But, you know, even when there's a violent act and the person, it turns out, does have a mental illness, that might not be why, because there are all of these other factors. Some of them are demographic, being young and being male. I mean, if we could do something about being male, that would do a lot to reduce gun violence. illicit drug abuse, substance abuse is a very important factor, and that can work pharmacologically, like by disinhibiting violent impulses. It can also, you know, the kinds of behaviors and risk factors that people are exposed to in the social environment when they are acquiring drugs and alcohol, that can be a factor. A whole range of sort of social pathologies that tend to be concentrated with poverty. Childhood physical abuse. I mean, if we had healthier communities where people, we didn't have so many kids exposed to trauma who grow up to be perpetrators, we would have less violence. It's just exposure to the violence in the social environment. So there are a lot of things that come together. And it's not a one thing problem, and it's not a one thing solution.
I've heard people point to the role of anger, impulsive anger, histories of angry, violent behavior as a predictor for more serious acts of violence down the road. Is that part of the story?
Well, it is. You know, my colleagues and I published a paper a couple of years ago in which we analyzed data from a national survey, a psychiatric epidemiological survey that was representative of the whole country. What we wanted to do was estimate the prevalence of two things coming together: people who have sort of pathological anger traits, impulsive angry behavior. These are the kind of people, when they get angry, they break and smash things. And so it's uncontrolled, it's unpredictable, it's destructive, and have access to firearms. And that description applies to about 9% of the adults in this country have access to guns at home and have some of these anger traits that are serious. And 1.5% of the adults in this country have impulsive angry behavior and are carrying a gun around with them. You know, we're not going to live in a world where we don't have angry people. I mean, anger is a normal human emotion on a continuum. So it's hard to say, well, you know, anger is a problem in itself. But when you're talking about extreme anger that's uncontrolled and destructive, you don't want people like that to have access to a gun. You know, in other countries, you might have two impulsive, angry, intoxicated young men in the middle of the night, and somebody gets punched in the nose or gets a black eye. In our country, it's far more likely that somebody's got a handgun, and then you end up with a dead body, and that's embedded in our homicide rates.
Well, something we haven't really taken head on here so far is the idea of access to firearms. So, gun control, obviously a very controversial topic legislatively and in the courts. Is there some way to have targeted restrictions, legislation that would keep guns out of the hand of impulsive and angry people?
Right. Well, you know, in this regard, Rob, we are different from many of our peer countries in Western Europe and the UK and Australia and Japan. Many of those countries have taken the position that, you know, the idea that everybody should have a right to have a handgun for their personal protection, that's just too dangerous. And so they broadly limit legal access to guns. They make exceptions for certain people under certain conditions, hunters and so on. But in our country, we take a different approach because private gun ownership is constitutionally protected. I mean, it's also the case that, you know, we live in a country where guns are, you know, we celebrate guns in our culture. We have domesticated guns, and we have a heck of a lot of them, 310 million firearms in private hands. So the place we start with policy, particularly after the landmark United States Supreme Court decisions and the Heller decision and McDonald, that essentially established that the Second Amendment confers an individual right possess a firearm, is with gun control here isn't really gun control so much as it is people control. We have to try to figure out who are the people who are so dangerous that it is justified to limit their Second Amendment right, because the Supreme Court has said that it is a right, but it's not an unlimited right. So we have to kind of figure out what those limits are. And I don't think we're doing a great job with that, because the criteria that we have are too broad and too narrow at the same time. They identify lots of people, you know, limit their right to have a gun, who aren't probably going to be dangerous, and they fail to get a lot of people who are. And some of these angry, impulsive people are people I'm talking about.
We'll dig more into that in just a few moments. We're talking about gun violence and mental illness. Our guest is Jeffrey Swanson from Duke University. He says we often overestimate the connection between mental health problems and gun violence.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Should mental illness be a focus of public policy aimed at preventing gun violence? Would you support gun background checks that pay more attention to past incidents of violence and impulsive anger and less on mental illness? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation now about gun violence and mental illness in the United States with psychiatry professor Jeffrey Swanson from Duke University. He says the connection isn't as strong as we might think, and there are better ways to think about gun violence if we want to prevent it.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think we focus too much on the link between mental illness and gun violence? If you've dealt with mental illness yourself or in your family, do you see a stigma attached to this conversation about violence and mental illness? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Before we go to our callers, Jeffrey, I wanted to follow up on what you were saying. You're saying our laws right now are in some ways too narrow, in some ways too broad to keep the guns out of the hands of people who are likely to do harm with them. What kind of change would you like to see that you think might be effective?
Well, you know, a history of any kind of violent behavior is a far better predictor of future violence than mental illness is. And I'll give you a couple of examples. You know, many states do not prohibit firearms from people who have a misdemeanor violent crime conviction. If it's not a felony, it's not going to be a gun prohibitory under federal law. But some states do that. California, for example, prohibits firearms from violent misdemeanors. That is something that other states could do. There's evidence and there's research that suggests that any kind of violent behavior is a risk factor for a more serious violent behavior. Another thing would be temporary domestic violence restraining orders. So those are individuals who, let's say, a judge in an ex parte order has issued a temporary domestic violence order of protection, but in the period before it becomes permanent, some states allow that suspected perpetrator of domestic violence to keep his firearm. That's a high-risk time. That's a time when guns could be temporarily prohibited. What about people who have multiple DUIs and DWIs? We know that that is alcohol, a problematic alcohol abuse is connected to violence. Those are the kinds of things that could be used. And also, we could have state laws that would authorize a preemptive removal of firearms from people who are really dangerous, who pose a high risk of harming others or themselves, even if they don't fall into one of these prohibited categories.
Let's bring in our callers now at 800-642-1234. Patrick is with us now in Madison. Patrick, hi.
Hi. I had a question about gun deaths and suicide and in terms of what percentage of overall suicides are due to purposeful self-inflicted gunshot wounds. And if we were to kind of enact some sort of law or make some sort of change to get the guns out of their hands, would that affect the suicide rate, or would those ill people still likely commit suicide via some other means?
Patrick, thanks a lot for that call. And I know this is a question that comes up. Well, if not with a gun, somebody would commit suicide in another way. Is there something about guns that makes that suicide risk higher, Jeffrey?
Well, that's a great question, what the caller is really talking about is you know, how lethal is a particular suicide attempt. What we know is that if people try to end their own life and they use anything but a gun, they're actually quite likely to survive. The case fatality rate is maybe about 10%. So most people who try to commit suicide with something else survive. And if they do survive a suicide attempt, the research shows us that people are unlikely to die from suicide. They're a little more likely than if they had never tried it before, but most people who survive suicide go on and die from something else at an older age. What that means is that limiting access to really lethal means, like a gun, is very important, because if people try to end their life and they use a gun, they almost never survive, because it's a direct shot to the brain, nobody else is there, and about 85 to 90% of those individuals die. So, you know, think about here is a very distraught, intoxicated, impulsive young person who's feeling hopeless and depressed. And if they've got a gun and they use that to try to end their life, they're not going to get that second chance. And I think that's really why it's important. We do know there's some substitution of means. But it's really not that great.
Patrick, thanks for bringing that up. We'll go next to Dory with us in Madison. Dory, hi.
Hi. I wanted to say that one thing that always bothers me about this discussion is that the term mental illness is too generic and it's painting with too wide a brush. I've known a lot of people with diagnosed mental illnesses like depression and bipolar syndrome that I feel completely safe around. At the same time, I don't believe that somebody who goes out and buys a gun and shoots 50 people fits my definition of sane. So I'm wondering if we should narrow the definition of a particular type of mental illness that might lead to more violence while leaving the vast majority of people who have mental illnesses out of the discussion because they don't deserve to even be part of it.
Dory, thanks for that call. So, and a lot of people might look at homicides of various levels as, well, it's not a sane act. So it is in itself a type of mental illness, I guess, Jeffrey.
Well, that's a very good point, and it's always important to try to define what we mean by mental illness when we ask the question, is mental illness related to violence? But let me be clear about one point. I mean, you don't have to be a psychiatrist to say that, you know, someone who goes out and deliberately massacres a bunch of strangers, I mean, that is not the act of a healthy-minded person. That's the act of a deeply disturbed person, whatever diagnosis they might have. So I don't think we help the discussion by saying, you know, that some people who commit mass public shootings might, you know, not have a particular diagnosis or another. And it is true that, you know, we need to be more specific. When I say serious mental illness, it's kind of a shorthand, and I'm referring to people who have one of the major acute psychiatric diagnoses that impair reasoning, perception of reality, thought, regulation of mood, including schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, major depressive illness. And yes, there are some differences in terms of risk of violence across those diagnostic groups. But in general, there's a relative risk of maybe about 3 to 1, but the absolute risk is quite low. If you factor out substance abuse, maybe about 7% of individuals in each of those diagnostic groups will do something violent in a year, and the vast majority will not, even if the relative risk is a little bit high. And the attributable risk is about 4%, which means if we were to eliminate, cure magically those disorders, which would be wonderful, about 96% of our violence out there in society would still be there. It doesn't mean that people who commit violence don't have some problems, maybe personality problems, and so on. But I think that's very important to try to be more specific about what we mean.
I wonder, Jeffrey, if there's something to be said for risk awareness, for people to self-recognize that they are in a state in their life where they might be at risk for suicidal behavior or for that sort of impulsive anger you were talking about earlier, or for maybe friends and family members to spot, I know this person, I know they're at risk of harming themselves or others, and I know they have firearms, and somehow trying to intervene, either self, get rid of your guns for yourself, or talk to a person or authorities or something like that? Long-winded question, I'm sorry, but is there something to that?
I think so. I mean, there are times in the sort of illness and treatment career of people with mental illnesses when we know that risk is elevated. For example, when people are brought into to a healthcare facility, like to an emergency department, for a short-term hold for evaluation in a mental health crisis, that's a time when we know that risk is elevated. Many of those individuals do not lose their gun rights because that event does not progress to a full involuntary civil commitment in a judicial proceeding with a lawyer and all that, in which case they would lose their gun rights. But, you know, there is an innovative law that is getting a lot of attention throughout the United States. The precursors of it were in Connecticut and Indiana, but most recently in California. It's called the Gun Violence Restraining Order, and that was enacted in California after the shooting in Santa Barbara. Elliot Rodger is a perfect example of that because he was emotionally disturbed. His family was concerned about him. They called the police to come and check on him, and the police came and paid a social welfare check and determined he didn't meet the criteria to be detained. But with the gun violence restraining order, it's a civil proceeding where a judge can decide that this person should not have access to guns, and they can actually separate that person from the guns temporarily until they no longer pose a threat. And in the states where this is being tried, in Connecticut and Indiana, it's used most often for suicide concerns. And the family, because it really gives a legal tool to family members and police and law enforcement with due process, with a judge looking in and weighing in on it, to separate guns from people at a time when they might really pose a high risk of harming themselves or others.
We'll leave it there for now, Jeffrey. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
That's Jeffrey Swanson, professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the Duke University School of Medicine.